There's 360, 70 million people in this country, roughly. There's roughly 800,000 law enforcement officers. That 800,000 compared to that 370 million is the thin blue line that keeps this country from going to total anarchy and chaos. That's pretty wild if you think about it.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I hope you've also discovered and are listening to our new show, Deadly Diocese. It's a deep dive in real time, an investigation into the suspicious death of a Catholic priest in Buffalo, New York. We are continually tracking leads, doing interviews, following up on our close to 2-year investigation into Father Joseph Moreno's untimely and mysterious death, shrouded in corruption and blatant mishandling and cover-ups. So with all that said, I thought I'd do somewhat of a crossover between the two shows for this week's episode. Number one, because we really want to get justice for Father Joe, his twin sister, his ailing father, and his beloved niece. They deserve answers. They deserve justice. And they deserve not to be shut down or shut up for one more day, like they have been for the past 10 years. And number two, I really enjoyed my groundbreaking interview with retired Buffalo police officer and friend of Father Joe, and just overall wonderful man, Tom Sino, who I spoke to in his first ever public interview about Father Joe earlier this week, where I got chills down my spine when he was so willing at the beginning of the conversation to say, without my prompting, Father Joe did not kill himself. And after that, we were off to the races. But weaved into that conversation, I began to learn more about the trauma police officers and any first responder faces on a daily basis, and the effects that trauma has on first responders. And it got me thinking. That is a side of true crime I bet many of us, I know I hadn't put much thought into it until I spoke to Tom, rarely think about when we are listening to a podcast about a case. Of course, we will always sympathize and have our hearts break for the victims and their families. But what about the men and women who get routine patrol calls, show up completely unprepared for what they might see or the danger they might experience, hoping it's a false alarm, only to find themselves looking at the lifeless body of any person, let alone sometimes a child? How would that affect a person? Personally, I don't think I could do it day in and day out. I just simply wouldn't have the strength. But these men and women do it. And they, of course, deserve the thank you and recognition. But don't you think they also deserve help? Help both mentally, emotionally, and even physically. Because no one prepares you for the emotional toll being a first responder is going to take on you. There's a void in the system, and my new friend, Tom Sino, enlightened me today on this second interview I had with him. So today for Seven Deadly Sinners, this is a special episode highlighting what these men and women experience, and how they are often just left out in the cold with no support after a traumatic crime scene is burned into their consciousness, keeping them up at night and sometimes drowning it in a bottle.
I'm not a scientist by no means. I'm a street cop. But every time you have a traumatic event, that sticks with you.
After working for 20 plus years as a police officer, not having backup is kind of scary.
Failing those who serve.
Police officers battling post-traumatic stress disorder and being unable to get the help that they need.
Police officers who are dealing with wounds that we simply cannot see.
PTSD is one of the biggest issues plaguing law enforcement.
I was standing in my bathroom and I had my gun in my mouth. That night, I just laid down to sleep, and as I'm laying there,
and that's when he was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
I didn't know any of this.
Trying to heal from the traumas that had put me in the position that I was in, I suddenly lost all the support of all the guys I worked with.
I personally have watched my friends die. Seeing children that had been raped to death, it all started to come back.
Every child death that I had been a part of, any major crime scene, all of a sudden they were all with me, coming out and talking about it or reaching out to anybody.
Many cities' insurance companies consider traumatic incidents as part of a police officer's job.
The officers left me right because of this issue that they won't address.
I wanted to share this story with Tom while we were on the phone, but I didn't want to interject a secondhand experience to him while he was sharing his own very real firsthand experience. But I do believe he would have resonated with the story, and since he's my new friend, I'll just tell him the next time I talk to him. A lot of what you'll hear Tom say reminded me of a story I heard from a soldier I met on a military base in Germany back in 2015, a story I will never forget. I can still visualize this troubled and shaken handsome soldier and his story of essentially being forgotten while serving for our country. So I'd like to share this story with you before we hear from Tommy, because I think trauma from war zones are not so far removed from the trauma a street cop in Buffalo might feel. You never know what you're going to see. You never know how it's going to affect you. And like this brave soldier, these brave cops often feel left out alone, hearing the rest of the world bustle along with their own dark thoughts, keeping them awake, more isolated and uncared for as the world moves past them. So back in 2015, I was doing what's the equivalent of a USO tour, but it was AFE, Armed Forces Entertainment. Me and four other stand-up comedians were performing for the troops overseas. We went to Kosovo, Belgium, Germany, the UK, several places. One place got canceled because I think it was an active war zone. Although Kosovo was still considered an active war zone when we went there, but whatever. We had to go behind a blast wall. It's not a big deal. Anyways, so we were on this base in Stuttgart, Germany, and we had finished our performance, and oftentimes afterwards we would kind of mix and mingle with the soldiers. And on this particular base, kind of Greek god-looking, very handsome guy wanted to talk to us. He was a soldier who I can't remember his exact special forces team, but it's whatever team goes in first in, you know, active war. And I believe that he had recently been in Afghanistan, and this is where this happened. So anyways, he walks up to us, he starts talking to us, and we wanted to go out in the town of Stuttgart, like off the base. And we invited him along. We were like, do you want to come? And he was all excited. He wanted to come. And so he then turned to a woman that was kind of like trailing him. And he asked her if it was okay if he went. And she said, are you sure you're like capable of this? Like, is this going to be safe for you? Do you? So he did have some care. He had a sponsor of sorts. So I guess it is slightly different than the stories that Tommy is going to tell. But when you hear what got this man to this position, you'll understand the parallel I'm trying to make. So anyways, he asks her if it's okay if he goes. She checks in with him and she says it's fine. So he goes out with us. And we go to this cool old bar in Germany. And pretty soon after his first beer, he begins to cry. And me and one of the other comedians, Mark Saratella, I believe Jill Kimmel was listening a lot too. We just heard his story. And his story was probably, I don't know how to describe it. Just hear the story, and I think it will stick with you in your gut like it did for me. So he's telling us about a fairly recent active battle he was in. And they went in first, and he watched most of his friends die. And he had been fighting. And all he had been looking forward to that week before he had to go into that battle was that Toby Keith was going to be performing on their base. It is all he cared about. He was so excited because they get really excited for like outside entertainment and, you know, connection to the outside world. And it's all he cared about. He was so excited, but then he had to go into this battle where he saw the most traumatizing thing a person can see, was actively involved in it. And when he arrived back on base, he was not allowed on. They felt that maybe he was not well adjusted enough after that active combat to be mixing and mingling amongst his peers on the base. So instead of checking in with him, getting him immediate therapy or debriefing, everything, they just made him sleep by himself outside. And he could hear Toby Keith playing on bass just from like a far distance. That's how they treated a person that watched all their friends die. It truly broke my heart. The thought of being alone with your own thoughts after that, and then all you wanted to do was hear this country concert, and you had to be alone in the cold by yourself in a tent, not even allowed to have the creature comforts of a bed. It just stuck with me. And it reminded me of a lot of the stuff that we're going to hear from Tom Sino now.
Yes, yeah, so I was born to be a policeman. I've been wanting to be a policeman since I was like 5 years old. I remember standing up in junior year in high school in my plumbing class. I was in a vocational school, and the teacher was asking everybody what their plans were for their future. And I remember I stood up and said I wanted to be a New York State trooper. And that was in high school. And then eventually I started, you know, once I got out of high school, I went to a city college or a community college, I should say, and started working on my criminal justice degree. And in 1991, I was hired with the City of Buffalo Police Department as a patrol officer. It's one of the best time of my life, one of the better times of my life, I should say. It was an ecstatic day for me to be, given a badge and given a job I always dreamed of. And from there, it went on. I worked actually 2 years down at the Buffalo Police Headquarters, which used to contain 44 cells. So I wasn't happy with that, but unfortunately I was low man on the totem pole and I had to take the job because that's the way it worked. So yeah. For my first 2 years on a job, I basically had to deal with incoming prisoners, strip searching them, and then fingerprinting and photographing them before, you know, the morning so they could go off to court.
Is 44 cells a fairly big, like, local jail or prison?
Well, it's like a jail. It's like a holding jail. So 44 cells is a pretty good amount. Mm-hmm. For being on the fourth floor of a police headquarters building. So it was a fair amount. And, you know, we also were in charge of the care of the prisoners, you know, giving them some food and checking on them every 30 minutes to make sure their welfare was fine. If we had somebody who was suicidal, we would have to check them every 15 minutes and make rounds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the good part of that aspect of the job, I guess, looking back on a positive of it, I got to learn most of who was on the police department from seeing them coming up with arrests. And I also got to learn my charges, you know, my penal law charges pretty quickly to where I was able to memorize them and, you know, whatever, you know, I could tell, if they were in there for shoplifting, it was penal law 15525, you know.
Yeah.
If they were, I got to learn all my charges, which was pretty beneficial and pretty good for me. Mm-hmm. And useful on the streets. So finally I was released to the streets. Well, when I first got on in 1991, it was just the regular, crimes. It was criminal mischief, burglary, domestic violence. It was assault, criminal trespass, criminal possession of stolen property or drugs, gun possession. It was a vast variety of charges that people were in there for. Yes, we had a couple murderers, of course, come through those doors. We have actually had a couple NFL players come through the doors.
Oh, wow.
I fingerprinted one of the Buffalo Bills. I won't say his name. But, so when I got on the street, we were two-man cars. And so that meant we had two men in each car, a man and a woman. And it was great. I was actually able to hook up with a childhood friend of mine who never wanted to really be a cop, but took the exam and got hired about 2 years before me. So we were able to hook up as partners and rode a while. And that was kind of fun. As you can imagine, two childhood friends driving around.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of my career. Unfortunately, also, we wound up going from two-man cars to one-man cars, which is totally dangerous and was a bad decision, but that's the decision that was made from the department. And eventually we were one-man cars, which a lot of agencies do now, which I don't agree with. I think there should be two-man cars in the city.
Is that like to save money, or what's the reasoning for that?
Their reasoning, they had actually had old-fashioned precincts when I started. So what they started doing in the mid-90s was started to consolidate and make the precincts districts. So they would take like three precincts and consolidate all that area and now make it a district. They sold the public on they were going to have more police protection, but that was false. That was far from the truth. They actually had less police protection from going to precincts to the districts. But they got away on the public on that one.
Oh, interesting.
So I was just a regular street cop. I got married the following year. I had twin girls in 1995, so a few years after that. And, I worked all types of shifts. I worked the midnights. I worked the second shift. I worked days. And then in 1996, roughly, is when I had an incident at work with other officers where there was an in-custody death. And it pretty much threw me for a loop because the media and how most of the media work in this country are not truthful or factual. They spun it off like it was a conspiracy of officers who killed this guy. And every day in the paper, on the radio, in the news, you start, you're drawn to it to see what's being said. But then when you're seeing what's being said, it's hurting your heart inside. You know what I'm saying? So for a year, I went through some really hard times with my own personal self until I finally went to go see a psychiatrist that was recommended from a good friend of mine and sat down with him. And the guy turned a piece of paper around and said, "Hey man, you're not going crazy. You have post-traumatic stress disorder." And I was like, "Okay, thank God. At least I know I'm not going crazy." So
yeah.
The second thing that was then thrown at me was, medication. Well, in that type of world, the law enforcement world, at least back then, my thought process was, what medication? I don't need no medication. I'm not crazy. I'm too tough for that. Well, a good friend said, basically said, "Tommy, if you knew how many people who were on antidepressants your head would spin, please give it a try." So I did. And it worked. It saved my life, actually, taking that medication. And I've been on it ever since. You work patrol, and that was my life. I loved it. I loved the people on the street. I was very much in tune with the people on the street, all the good, the bad, and ugly. A lot of unseen heroes go out there, unknown, who do a lot of special things for people, both on the job and off the job. I had a domestic abuse case involving a man, a woman, and a young girl. And the young girl was pretty much emotionally and, mentally broken down. She was young at the time, in her teens. And I remember having a connection with her and feeling bad for her because she felt so hopeless. And she was in such a terrible place with her father, who was the big problem. And I can remember sitting down talking with her after I chewed her father out pretty heartily. I sat down with her and I talked to her. And I just told her about life, and I told her about, the hope that's out there and what do you want to do for a living? What are your dreams? What are your aspirations? And I subsequently have seen that girl over the years grow into a young woman, a confident young woman. Every time I see her and it's here or there, it's like once every year, a couple of years, she's doing so well for herself and she's so confident and she got herself out of that situation and she's successful. I forgot what she does for a living, but, we remain friends, and that happens quite often, and that happened with many people with me.
That's really special. Wow. I feel like a lot of people don't realize that cops can be there for people like that. I think that's very, very special.
Yeah, I wore my heart on my sleeve. I could act the tough guy part when I wanted to act the tough guy part, but I truly wasn't a tough guy. I mean, I could handle my own, but I had a heart. I was brought up by a great mother who taught me about, Jesus and God, who are my higher power, and just being love and caring and that's it. Just watching out for others, caring for others, and because you get so much back when you do that. And I was at work with others, and we watched, I believe, the second plane hit, and my total instinct was, we have to go. I have to go. And long story short, our department, which was quite embarrassing, never sent a full contingency of officers or police cars to New York City, which in fact was like 6 hours away. They compiled a list and kept telling us, whoever wants to volunteer in New York City, right, put your name on the list. And of course, every day went by and nobody was being shipped off anywhere, to the point where it's getting utterly disgusting for me because I was watching it every day and I needed to be there because that's what we do. Wow. So lo and behold, I got 8 other people from my district to join me. We were ordered by the department not to wear uniforms. We were ordered by the department not to take our weapons. We were ordered by our department that we had to use our own personal time and we had to use our own personal cars. So nine of us. Oh, yeah. That's a whole other. But 9 of us drove to New York City. And that is when I finally, I think we had about 10 years on the job. Yeah, 2001. And I had always been pretty opinionated, and most departments and leaders in departments don't like opinionated people because you're like the problem child. But whenever I was opinionated, I was doing it for the right reasons, and I wouldn't step off my box, especially if I knew I was right. Mm-hmm. But we wound up there, and I remember the instant where I stood next to a trooper or patrol officer. We were limited to what we could do because we didn't have anything. We didn't have any uniforms. We didn't have any guns. We didn't have anything. So they sent us down to one of the piers to work security. And I can remember standing next to a guy from Wisconsin in full uniform. He drove his police car there. And I can remember how small I felt. and how embarrassed I was being from Buffalo, New York. And here I was wearing a pair of jeans, you know, some work boots and a polo shirt. And, but anyhow, the good part of it is I was able to make it to Ground Zero with another person that came with me, a rookie. And we worked a shift in Ground Zero overnight on the Bucket Brigade. And it was just so surreal and so movie-like, it hard to comprehend, but it was a blessing to have gotten there. And, severe structural damage of buildings, twisted metal, fire still burning, smoke still smoking, just a silence among, you know, a silence in the air, you know, when people were on the Bucket Brigade, you know, taking the smaller debris and passing it in by buckets all the way down the line to where it would be dumped in a pile. If they thought they heard something or if they thought they found something, somebody would blow a whistle and it would become totally and eerily silent.
Wow.
And they would listen intently to see if they did in fact hear something or not, and then go back to work if that was the case. So when I was there, again, it was, I got there September 16th, so it's not like I saw body parts and bodies because most of those have all been removed, but what I did see was personal items strewn across concrete, you know, and steel, you know, persons, shoes.
That's heartbreaking.
Somebody's book. Somebody's baseball cap, you know, just personal items strewn all over the place. Yeah, it was an experience. It was I was thankful to God for it because I couldn't sit around. And because I had came back and wrote a full page article in our Blue Line, which is the PBA newspaper, I still got a copy. When I say a full page, the pages are huge. And I basically blasted the mayor and the commissioner and everybody.
Good for you.
Well, yeah, good for me, yeah, because that was the right thing to do. But unfortunately, you know, a lot of the people that went got cornered by the upper echelon people and were chastised. Here are people that volunteered on their own time. And they're being cornered by the administration and being chastised and put down for going. It was terrible. Yeah. So then I got a call one day and it said I needed to go to the deputy police commissioner's office. So I knew what that was about. So I went down and he was a big guy like me, big muscular guy. And he was like the muscle for the department, for the commissioner. And I was ready for battle because I wasn't backing down. I wasn't getting off my box. I was there. I saw what they needed. I knew what they needed. And Buffalo, New York should have sent police that same day. And I walked into his office and was expecting a screaming match or shoving match or something of that sort. And that never occurred. Although I'm sure he went back and told the police commissioner that he gave it to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But within his office, he talked calmly with me and basically said, you know, I think you're a little, I forgot the word he used, misinformed or something to that effect. And I kept my mouth shut. And then when he prompted me to speak, I said, sir, I stand 100% on my box and what I said in that news, you know, in that newspaper, in that, union paper. And he looked at me and he put his hand out and shook my hand and said, have a good day. So I think the purpose of it was for him to jump all over me and intimidate me and try to frighten me. That's at least what his boss thought he was going to do. But in fact, he did not do that. And I believe he had somewhat of respect for me and left it at a handshake and I walked out of his office. So, again, right back to patrol. And then in 2004, I wound up having the flesh-eating bacteria in my right leg. Well, if you could always Google it. You can Google by name and, you know, and put in Buffalo police officer battles flesh-eating bacteria. What flesh-eating bacteria is, it's called necrotizing fasciitis. That's the scientific name for it. And what it's caused by is strep or staph infection. And it could be something as slight as a spider bite, a scratch, a bruise. What most people don't understand, of course, I never knew this until after almost dying from it, is that even a bruise, when you bruise your arm, the skin is damaged. And in that particular bruised area, it is very susceptible for germs to go through that skin, that bruised skin, and enter your system.
I had no idea about, wow, okay.
So, and it's the same strep that causes strep throat. And my daughters, my twins, get strep throat all the time. But this becomes invasive, and it will kill you. So I wound up having I wound up having a pain in my right leg. It was a Saturday. I was at my daughter's soccer game or softball game, and my ex-wife at the time was, my wife at the time, now my ex, was like yelling at me, "Stop! Get your hand out of your crotch. Get your hand out of your crotch." I'm like, my leg is hurting, my inside of my leg. So I wound up going home, and I was in pain. And then the next day I said, I'm driving to the hospital. I said, something's wrong. And I drove myself to the hospital, and they did some kind of a CAT scan, and they saw something in there. And I thought it was, okay, cancer or something to that effect, because, you know, that seems to be everywhere. And it wound up being one of my lymph nodes. And your lymph nodes in your body are basically the size of peas, if not smaller. And mine was the size of a golf ball.
Oh, wow.
So they said, well, actually, they didn't know it was a lymph node at the time until they went in. But they basically said, we got to go in and take whatever that is out. And I've always been good with surgeries. I'm not afraid of going getting put under a knife. And I said, go get it out. So they took this out. And then, that's when they found out it was an infected lymph node. And they sutured me up and they sent me back home. And on the following Monday, I still had the pain. And I started to progressively get worse. My health started to decline. My kids were at school. My wife at the time was at work. And the kids came home. And they had a softball game or soccer game, one of the two. And my wife came home. And I remember telling her, I can't go. I don't feel good. I'm nauseous. I am weak. I'm sweaty. And she had left in about 30 minutes. Within 30 minutes, I was, I didn't have enough strength to push myself off my couch. So I wound up having to throw up in a towel. And then when I wound up getting to the bathroom, my urine was dark brown. And when you see dark brown urine, that's never a good sign. That means your organs are shutting down.
Oh,
so I called my wife. And I told her, you got to get me to ECMC, which is a number one trauma hospital here in Buffalo, New York. They did a CAT scan. They said, you got to go in OR right now. You have the flesh-eating bacteria. And I can remember telling the surgeon, I said, and I knew where the pain was. I said, just take my leg. I could get another leg, but don't let it kill me. Don't let it go up my groin and up into my torso. Just please, just take my leg off and I'll get another leg.
Oh,
and he said to me, well, you just wait and see what we were able to do. So I was in ICU for 2 weeks. They debrided my right leg twice. So I have like a 14 long by 7-inch wide concave scar on my right inner thigh. And I was in the hospital a month. It was quite a hard time because I was in a lot of pain, and my white blood count would go up and down on a daily basis. So my infection was there and not there and then there and then not there. But I wound up living, and it was a blessing. It was a blessing. I had 4 months off total, and I went back to work after 4 months. Oh, well, I've been into Garth Brooks since the 90s. He's the one who got me in the country. I admire the man. I hope to meet him someday. I'm destined to meet him, I feel, in my heart. When I got out of the hospital, a good friend of mine who was a priest, Father Joe, would call me and say, did you get a phone call yet? And I said, what do you mean a phone call? He said, call me when you get a phone call. So one day I went out to my truck and started my truck and was going to rehab for my leg, and I left something in the house, and I walked back into the house, well, hobbled into the house with a cane, and came back, and I had a missed phone call. So I missed the phone call. I, you know, played my voicemail, and it wasn't Garth Brooks. And he said, Tom, he said, this is Garth Brooks. He said, I'm getting on a plane with my wife in Nashville, and just want to let you know, I heard about your situation, and we're praying for you and wish you the best. And I couldn't believe, first of all, I missed a call. So that sucked. But secondly, you know, there was not a phone number to call back, because I would have been definitely calling him back. But I kept that voicemail, and I let my family and my kids and everybody listen to that voicemail. And then I had a couple officers from the department come out to my house, drop off some paperwork one night, because I was still on leave of absence, and I let them listen to it, and I hit the 9 instead of the 7, and I raised the message. So, yeah, it was super cool. It was super, it really lifted me up, it really did. And it was wonderful, and it was all, you know, just set up by Father Joe, who was an amazing person. That was on a weekly basis. In the city of Buffalo or any big city, you're going to see murder. You're going to see people taking their last breaths, shot off the beds. You're going to see all that. But, yeah, we had a call of two children and a mother ran over in a park. I drove like a crazy man to get there. I was the first car on the scene. One of the toddlers was alongside the curb. He was already dead. His female sister, who was a toddler, she was on the ground with her eyes going side to side and not really doing much. And the mother was just so hysterical and beside herself. What happened was a gentleman driving down the expressway actually fell asleep. And he wasn't on drugs. He wasn't drunk. He just fell asleep. And there had really not been any guardrails in that particular area. Now there is. Of course, something bad had to happen. But the car went off into the park and ran over the lady with her two children in the stroller.
Oh, my God.
So we were there a good part of the day, along with the firefighters. You know, the firefighters see the same stuff we see. The little daughter survived, little girl. The boy didn't. And we all went back to the precinct. I was one of the last ones back to the precinct with a lieutenant friend of mine. And everybody had been gone already. And me and the lieutenant walked in, and there was nobody there to meet the officers. There was nobody there to debrief the officers. There was nobody there to, hold a critical incident meeting with the officers. Everybody went home, including myself, the lieutenant, just wondering what we were going to drink that night. And the next morning, the whole platoon was in and back to work and just do what we do. So nobody really got any help from anybody. The department at that time, I believe they were having an organization that was there to help the police, and if they did, it certainly wasn't there that day. That's part of the problem with law enforcement today. If you talk to a lot of people and a lot of departments, they don't have, or they're not prepared to help these officers after a critical incident. Nobody is sent over to try to debrief them, to help them. And again, I don't know what holds true nowadays with my old department. I'm just talking about when I was there. Well, when I went to the police academy, they said, welcome, hello. And they said, your suicide rate your divorce rate and your alcoholism rate is 3 times higher than the national average. And you're like, wow, welcome. I'm glad I'm here. But it's very true. At this point in time, I'll have 4 years clean and sober from alcohol in June.
Congratulations.
Because finally, it actually happened after I retired. I hit my rock bottom, and that's what it usually takes for people to hit their rock bottom. Unfortunately, some of them hit the rock bottom and kill themselves. I hit my rock bottom and knew I needed to go to a rehab. And I was enough to go to a rehab in Florida, which in fact, I'm now on one of their boards because they now have a thing at Futures. It's a place called Futures in West Palm Beach, but they now have a law enforcement program. And it's set aside from everyone else. And it's just law enforcement, first responders, military. I was blessed to be put on the board for that program, for that rehab down in West Palm Beach. So with drinking comes all the other bad stuff, loneliness, disparity, sadness. You instantly become an asshole and not know what. Not realize it, but you are. So slowly with my drinking, you know, I was burning my bridges with my coworkers. I was burning my bridges with my friends. I was burning my own bridges with my daughters. And nothing else mattered except for booze. And I also was addicted to pain pills. So everybody knew. I was able to get off the pain pills myself. But alcohol is a totally different drug, and it's one of the hardest drugs to actually, most people don't know this, what am I, detoxify from, to detox mm-hmm. from. You could cut your drinking cold turkey and die very quickly. Most of the drugs, you just go through a detox process, but you could get a seizure and die quickly from, you know, just stopping alcohol. Saying, I'm going to stop today and stop, and you could wind up dead. Yeah, it's a drinking and pills or whatever you take, it's a symptom of a bigger problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a symptom of a bigger problem, which in me, it's trauma, and that's PTSD and all the other traumas that I've never had addressed. And again, suicidal. I've lost a lot of friends to suicide. As a matter of fact, in Buffalo, I think the last year, presently, they've lost, I think, 4 people to suicide. Suicide's very prevalent. And all of this does not have to happen if they just had the correct support from their departments, most importantly, because you'll see if you interview a lot of cops, they don't have that much good to say about their departments or who's running their departments. Because most cops don't believe their departments don't have their back. And actually, I don't believe most departments have their officers back either. That's the other thing. There's nothing wrong with crying. What's wrong with crying? You know what? You're a human being again. We're all human. You know, but then again, you find yourself on a scene, family just lost a loved one, you're up standing up against the wall, observing and realizing what's happening, everybody's bawling. You might feel sad, but God forbid you cry. You don't want to cry because you're tough, you're a policeman, you know?
Yeah.
It's so twisted, it really is, but there is help, and I'm hoping that someday I could be part of that. I want to be able to speak on behalf of not only my life, but the things I've been through and how to teach these folks that they don't have to go that far with it.
Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please go on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave a 5-star rating and positive review. It really, really helps the show. And I hope you check out our other show, Deadly Diocese, because we really need to get justice for Father Joe. And if you have any tips on that case, please email us at deadlydiocese@gmail.com. Love you guys. Bye.